ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. This Wednesday, the latest inflation figures out today. What do they mean for interest rates? And Donald Trump faces damaging evidence in his New York criminal trial.
It was absolutely a terrible, horrific day for him. Obviously, the evidence that's coming out, I would not describe as resume builders for Mr. Trump. And it's hard to imagine that this is not going to have some impact.
The Federal Minister for Women says the rate of violence against women is a crisis. Advocates say at least 25 women have died in incidents of alleged gendered violence across the country so far this year. The alleged murder of a young woman in the New South Wales town of Forbes this week has prompted a public outcry. Molly Ticehurst's former partner has been charged. He was already facing serious domestic violence charges but had been released on bail. New South Wales Premier Chris Minns is set to order an urgent review of the state's bail laws. Rachel Mealy reports.
The Federal Minister for Women says Australian women don't feel safe.
You know, it's not safe to go out for a run, you go shopping, you take action against violent perpetrators, you do all the right things, and we still have these cases. And I don't think there's one easy answer. There's not. And there's not one government that can solve it because the problem is deeper than that and it requires all of us.
Katie Gallagher says it's an unacceptable situation affecting half the population.
This is a crisis in this country and women don't feel safe.
The New South Wales government is expected to order a review of bail conditions and court decisions made before Molly Ticehurst's alleged murder. Her former partner was facing serious charges, including rape, intimidation and stalking when he was released on bail 15 days before her death. He's now been charged with her murder. Premier Chris Minns says the community wants answers.
In relation to changes to the law, we need to understand what happened in the immediate run-up to this alleged crime.
28-year-old Molly Ticehurst worked at a childcare centre in Forbes and was well known in the local community. Phyllis Miller is the mayor of the Forbes Shire. She says her own grandchildren were cared for by Molly Ticehurst and she, like the rest of the community, feels distressed about her loss.
For parents to have to go and tell their little children that their carer and their childcare worker has died, I think is a really big thing, and that's why Molly's death and the job that she chose to do in her life has so much bearing on everyone that lives in Forbes. It's just a really sad, sad time.
The mayor supports a review of bail laws, particularly in regional areas.
That is the area that's letting down the good work that our policemen do. Admittedly, in rural regional New South Wales, we are under, we have not got the numbers that they've got in the city. They do a great job. And then you go to court and the judicial system lets them out. It's completely wrong. It's got to stop.
Delia Donovan is the Chief Executive of Domestic Violence New South Wales.
We want to see the nation step up and take action and our government step up and take action. We want more than words now. We want more than plans. We want to see action. We want to see accountability. And accountability is going to be key. And as a nation, we all have a role to play.
But she says there needs to be a wider overhaul of the court system than simply looking at bail laws.
It will be, what does domestic and family violence look like through the courts? How are magistrates responding? How's the criminal justice responding and really thinking about what domestic violence looks like, how it plays out, and what does trauma-informed practice look like? How are we risk assessing situations? Are we listening to police when it comes to bail reform? Are we looking at the conditions of bail? Are we, there's so much that I think we need to consider, and there's broader, beyond a bail reform or beyond the odd announcement. We need big, big reform and we need significant investment in this issue.
That's Delia Donovan there from Domestic Violence New South Wales, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. And victims of family violence who want help can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, you can call 000. Across Australia, people living in regional, rural and remote communities are 24 times more likely to be hospitalised as a result of family and domestic violence than people living in the major cities. Rachel Robertson is Principal Solicitor at Western Women's Legal Support in Dubbo.
We see that there's lots of added challenges with assisting clients in domestic violence situations in the rural communities that we service. Lots of women are out on properties, quite some distance from town. Their partners have access to firearms or other weapons, being farmers. There's often limited mobile phone service in certain areas.
And what about the issue of lack of anonymity? If a woman wants to go to the doctor or she's going to town to try and see a lawyer in a bigger town or go and get some counselling, people might know her vehicle or might know her face, and that can get back to the perpetrator. How much of an issue is that?
That's another huge issue. There's so many barriers, obviously, but that is another massive issue and another reason why people often don't reach out and get the help that they need. And that's even sometimes why services like ours, accessing or, you know, even travelling to the smaller towns, people are still reluctant to engage because, you know, if you're seen accessing a DV service, what you're seeking help for. So, yeah.
What sort of interaction do you see sometimes from the alleged perpetrator's family, their parents or others? Can there be pushback from that other family as well, that this can't possibly be going on, or don't you dare take kids away, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. And when there are children, that's very frequently the case. So it's another factor in the decision-making process, and that's why it's so difficult to not necessarily just leave.
How big is the issue of shame, particularly in the fishbowl of a small community? Not only those who are dealing with these situations feeling a sense of shame, but also for perpetrators and their families feeling that their family will be shamed if all of this comes out.
Yeah, again, another huge issue and something that we hear from our clients all the time. For some people, our service is the first service that they've disclosed the violence to because they're embarrassed to tell their friends and family and their loved ones. And look, ultimately, when you've been in a relationship with someone for a long period of time and share children and share your life with that person, it is really difficult to cut them off completely. And so often we see victims that are just haven't told anyone until they've told our service. So it's nothing to be ashamed of to try and get some help and to get some information and get some support wrapped around these victims.
What do you wish, what's the thing that you most wish that people understood about this situation for domestic and family violence in regional areas?
I think I wish that people realised, unfortunately, how common it is. There's so often that I have women in my office saying, I can't believe I've let myself get into this situation. And, you know, we have a conversation about how, I guess, that they feel so alone and they feel isolated. And that's not the case, unfortunately. It is unbelievably common. And if it wasn't, organisations like ours wouldn't exist and we wouldn't be at capacity all the time. I don't think people should feel they're alone and that there's something wrong with them because they're a victim of domestic violence. It is unfortunately so common. Yeah, it would be good to get that word out there. Don't be ashamed to seek help because, yeah, that's what we're here for.
That's Rachel Robertson there, Principal Solicitor at Western Women's Legal Support in Dubbo. You're listening to The World Today. Well, to the economy now, and there's some mixed news on inflation this lunchtime. While annual inflation is continuing to steadily fall, the most recent quarterly figures show it's not slowing fast enough. That means any interest rate cuts could be pushed out further than economists had been hoping. For more, I'm joined now by the ABC senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, take us through the figures.
Sally, the bottom line with these inflation figures is that they've come in hotter than expected, not exactly blowing out forecasts, but showing just how sticky or entrenched inflation currently is. In the first 3 months of this year, inflation rose by 1% against bets for 0.8%, and in the 12 months to March, a pace of 3.6%, once again slightly above the 3.5% forecast. But some important context, this is down from the quarterly reading in December of 4.1%. So inflation is steadily slowing, but as you mentioned, not fast enough. And this is, though, the fifth consecutive fall for inflation since it peaked at 7.8% in December 2022. The most significant price rises in the quarter were rents up 2.1%, secondary education, tertiary education up around 6%, medical and hospital services up 2.3%, which shows inflation is still problematic and will be a concern to the Reserve Bank, which wants to see inflation in that 2-3% band over time.
So, Peter, with inflation remaining a bit sticky, what are the chances of an interest rate cut later this year?
Well, Sally, trimmed mean inflation over the year is also down a little bit to 4%, but once again, that's above forecasts. And the Reserve Bank pays a lot of attention to trimmed mean or underlying inflation because it strips out volatile items like food and fuel, so you can get a much better picture of where inflation is sitting in the economy. But the fact that underlying inflation is still high is a worry. ANZ economist Catherine Birch remains confident that the RBA is on track to take rates down eventually, but she warns because inflation is still hot, don't rule out another rate hike this year.
We still think that the next move from the RBA will be a cut rather than a hike. But, you know, we also think that activity will start to improve this year as well. Inflation is now below wage growth, so household purchasing power is improving. We've got tax cuts coming through from the 1st of July, which will also boost household disposable income. And business investment and government spending is still looking reasonably solid. So you can't write off the possibility of the next move being a hike rather than a cut.
It's ANZ economist Catherine Birch there. Peter Ryan, finally, how has the market reacted to the latest inflation outcome?
Sally, the Australian dollar ticked just a bit higher in late morning trade up to 66.3 US cents on bets that the Reserve Bank's cash rate might stay higher for longer. The Australian inflation picture is now mirroring the United States, which is experiencing just how hard it is to get inflation lower. And as a result, bets have gone from three rate cuts in the United States this year down to just one. Similar here with predictions now moving to early 2025 for the Reserve Bank to deliver its first interest rate cut.
Peter Ryan, thank you. That's Peter Ryan, our senior business correspondent. Overseas now, and former US President Donald Trump has faced hostile evidence in his criminal trial in New York. Former publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, detailed a 2015 meeting with Mr. Trump and Mr. Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. Mr. Trump was implicated in a so-called catch-and-kill strategy to silence negative news about him during the 2016 presidential campaign. Nick Ackerman is a New York attorney and former assistant special Watergate prosecutor.
It was absolutely a terrible, horrific day for him. First of all, his lawyer tried to argue against Trump being held in contempt. The judge wasn't buying any of it. He really let the lawyer have it and basically told him he didn't trust him and held off on his decision. So I would think we're going to get a decision fairly quickly from the judge as to what he's going to do. But we will not know until we get that decision. On top of that, David Pecker, who was one of Trump's old cronies, was testifying against him and basically laying out the entire scheme that he, Trump, and Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former lawyer, had hatched to basically keep derogatory information about Trump out of the 2016 election so that the voters would never find out about it.
What do you think was some of the strongest evidence from Mr. Pecker when it came to this meeting at Trump Tower in 2015?
Well, I think the strongest evidence was explaining exactly how the National Enquirer worked and how it helped Donald Trump in his election. They did favorable stories on Donald Trump, and at Trump's urging, they did derogatory stories on some of his opponents, including Senator Ted Cruz. The paper wrote stories claiming that Ted Cruz's father was somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination, as crazy as that all sounds. At the same time, the major part of the scheme was to try and identify derogatory information from various women that Trump had been out with and had affairs with, and to what Pecker described as a catch and kill scheme, that is to catch the news and the information before it comes out, pay off the person, and basically kill it from ever seeing the light of day.
What's the timetable for this case now, Nick? How much longer have we got in this taking of evidence, and how does this sit on the timeline of campaigning and preparations for the presidential election?
Well, it's certainly not a positive for Donald Trump's election campaign. It's not giving him a lot of time. He's spending most of his time in court these days. It's hard to say how long this trial will go. It's been off to a slow start this week because we had jury selection last week that took a few days. This week has been slow because of the Jewish Passover holiday. And the judge, on top of it all, only meets 4 days a week. He doesn't meet on Wednesdays when he's got some other duties. Essentially, this case could be a three-week case, but it could go out longer because of the schedule and what else happens. But I don't think it's going to be that long of a case. I think it's going to be much shorter than people are predicting.
Is there any sense of public sentiment shifting as this initial evidence starts to come out?
Well, it's very hard to say, but obviously the evidence that's coming out, I would not describe as resume builders for Mr. Trump. And it's hard to imagine that this is not going to have some impact.
Nick Ackerman, it's always good to talk to you. I know it's been a long and busy day for you. We greatly appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's New York attorney Nick Ackerman. Australia's top spy boss says privacy is important but not absolute as he calls for social media companies to do more to help investigators. ASIO says extremists are using encrypted social media platforms to radicalise Australians, and there's little that law enforcement can do. But privacy campaigners worry that any government attempt to access encrypted conversations will do more harm than good. Angus Randall reports.
Every time you send a message over an app like WhatsApp, iMessage or Facebook Messenger, it's private from everyone, even the messaging companies. It's called end-to-end encryption. Dr. Vanessa Teague is from the Australian National University.
So the server, the provider, is relaying an encrypted message, but they cannot read it.
It's become an increasing problem for law enforcement, who say criminals, like most of the population, are increasingly turning to the technology. Federal Communications Minister Michelle Rowland has been in contact with ASIO and Federal Police.
On one side, of course, there is the responsibility to maintain privacy. On the other side, national security agencies are deeply concerned about having the appropriate tools to do their jobs in order to keep Australians safe.
In a speech to the National Press Club today, ASIO Director General Mike Burgess says these encrypted platforms can be used to create a safe space for terrorists to plan attacks. He understands the technology protects privacy, but says privacy is not absolute. Dr. Vanessa Teague says the ASIO head's comments are beside the point.
Nobody thinks that privacy is absolute. That's not the question. The question is whether deliberately undermining some of the most important tools for communication security actually makes all Australians more safe.
Dr. Teague says Australia already has stronger powers to access private messages than most countries, and she argues end-to-end encryption serves an important purpose, keeping everything from medical records and banking details to personal photos private.
I acknowledge that it can be used by bad people, but I think the trade-off, the idea that it should be undermined or turned off or delayed in order to stop bad people using it is wrong.
Even when law enforcement is granted a warrant to intercept communications, the agency still needs help from the company that owns and operates the app, which is usually based outside of Australia. ASIO head Mike Burgess says he's not calling for more powers or to ban end-to-end encryption. He wants the tech companies to do more. Professor Jill Slay is a cybersecurity expert from the University of South Australia. She says governments are paying the price for pushing companies to increase their security measures.
The social media companies are now saying that you forced us to use our technology to make the conversations private. We cannot now give you access to the same conversation because our technology is too complex. We can't undo it.
The security responsibilities of social media companies are under the microscope this week. The National eSafety Commissioner is taking social media platform X to court later today to force the platform to take down graphic videos of last week's Sydney church stabbing. X owner Elon Musk says it's a matter of free speech. Professor Slay says it's a debate over privacy that's a long way from being resolved.
What we're dealing with are deep legislative issues, philosophical issues about the right to privacy, and the criminal and terrorist mindset, which says we're going to use every kind of mechanism there is to sort of support our carrying out our crime or our mission.
The case will be heard in federal court later today.
That's Angus Randall. Thousands of junior doctors will receive hundreds of millions of dollars in unpaid overtime after the New South Wales government reached a landmark settlement on underpayments. After a long battle in the Supreme Court, New South Wales Health has agreed to pay $229 million. It's been called the largest settlement for an underpayment class action in Australian history. Nell Whitehead reports.
As a junior doctor at Sydney's Westmead Hospital, Dr. Amira Fakuri worked up to 100-hour weeks.
I was shocked at the long hours, at the hard work and the under-recognition we had as valuable members of our society.
The job, which she held between 2015 and 2018, included hours of unpaid overtime.
We were passionate about our jobs, and it was really sad and upsetting to know that despite all these years of study and hard work, we weren't recognised being paid for the overtime that we have done.
Now a GP in Melbourne, Dr. Fakuri was the lead plaintiff in a class action lodged in 2020 to recoup unpaid overtime for junior doctors in New South Wales. More than 3 years later, they're finally getting their paycheck.
But I guess for me, it's never been about the money. I did this for a cultural change to make it better for the next generation of junior doctors, for my fellow medical students.
New South Wales Health has agreed to pay almost $230 million in unpaid overtime to more than 20,000 junior doctors. That's the largest ever settlement for underpayment in Australia, according to Hayden Stevens of Hayden Stevens and Associates, one of two law firms behind the class action.
And so we're very, very proud for the legal achievement that is, but most importantly, proud for the junior doctors who have been able to stand up for their rights and stand up for what is fundamentally fair.
He says unpaid overtime has been widespread in hospitals and hopes this case will change that.
Where this is very much part of the culture or the business model of really how hospital is managed. These are, you know, deep cultural issues, really, I think, now calling out for proper investment, proper education and change in systems and processes to ensure that the hours that doctors work are safe.
The settlement still has to be approved by the Supreme Court, and it isn't the only class action being brought by junior doctors. Others are underway in Victoria and the ACT. Wage theft is a problem across the economy, according to a 2022 Senate report, which estimates workers are being underpaid by over $1 billion a year. John Buchanan is a professor at the University of Sydney's Business School.
The scale is enormous. There are two dimensions to it. The first is explicit wage theft, which is where their award arrangements or arrangements in enterprise agreements have not been honoured. The losses have been immense. And you've seen that big arrangements come through in the retail sector and now in the health sector. You're talking there about millions of people.
And he says the problem's been growing for years.
Many workers don't have enforceable rights, say, around shift work or set hours of work. Teachers, for example, academics. And there's, if you like, been over the decades, a significant erosion of any sense of standard hours for those people.
The National Tertiary Education Union estimated last year that universities had underpaid staff by almost $160 million since 2009. There have been wage theft cases against companies from Baker's Delight to the ABC and corporate giants like Coles and Commonwealth Bank. So what can be done about it? Professor John Buchanan again.
There's no shortcuts here. You need effective unions and effective industrial laws to sort it out. It's a fantasy to think that you can solve this workplace by workplace or individual by individual. Until we see the rebuilding of unions or a more active intervention from industrial tribunals, we're not going to see a societal-wide change.
That's Professor John Buchanan from the University of Sydney's Business School, ending that report from Nell Whitehead. That's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Samantha Donovan will be hosting PM later today with the latest news from across the country and around the world. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Australian political leaders have united in their condemnation of Elon Musk. And Musk is ready for a legal fight over the removal of videos and images of last week's Sydney church stabbing from his social media platform X, formerly Twitter. Today, host of Tech Podcast, Download This Show, Mark Fennell, on whether Musk can really be controlled. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.